Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
According to one expert, there's never been a generation of young Americans this depressed, this anxious, and this fragile.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan discusses youth mental health at a roundtable event in Anchorage. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a fund to subsidize rural energy costs will now be managed like the permanent fund.
Some years we get other legislators who want to maybe take some of these $1 billion that's currently sitting there for rural Alaska and use it for other purposes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy called youth mental health the defining public health challenge of our time at a roundtable in Anchorage today. He was speaking at an event organized by U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan on addressing Alaska's youth mental health crisis. Senator Sullivan said the crisis is severe and profound.
It's the pervasive depression, anxiety, and even focus on suicide of America's youth. And according to one expert, there's never been a generation of young Americans this depressed, this anxious, and this fragile. And of course, the numbers that we've seen, the data that relates to this is shocking.
For teens, Alaska has the highest rates of suicide in the country. American Indian and Alaska Native people are at the greatest risk. In May, the Surgeon General declared loneliness an epidemic in the United States, and he said young people experience even more loneliness than adults. Last month, he also released a report on the harms of social media on youth. He spoke about how it can distort values.
For too many young people, particularly on social media, the information that they're getting is an overload, frankly, of information that drives them to compare themselves constantly to other kids and to chase what I think of as the false gods of success and happiness, which are fame, power, and money.
In 2021, Sullivan argued that Congress should consider time limits on technology for youth. And at the roundtable, he said future legislation could increase the age limit for social media from 13 to 16, though it's unclear just how those limits would be enforced. Both Sullivan and Murthy talked about the importance of accessing data collected by social media companies. Current research shows that people who use social media experience higher risks of depression, anxiety, and addiction, but detailed data could help paint a clearer picture. Sullivan says legislation could force technology companies to release that data.
Can you imagine any other company in America saying, you know, sorry, we have data that may or may not show that what we're doing is harming kids, but we're not going to give it to you? Well, I think you're going to see some laws here soon saying, no, damn it, you are going to give it to us.
Sullivan didn't make any clear promises for future legislation or funding, but he said when 1 in 3 girls nationally are considering suicide, quote, nothing else should matter. Meanwhile, the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management and the Federal Emergency Management Agency gathered in Nome Friday for a post-Typhoon Murbach town hall meeting. KNOM's Ava White has the story.
Individuals were encouraged to attend to ask questions, hear updates, and find out more information regarding individual and public assistance plans to recover from damages. DHSE and FEMA announced that financial assistance is still available despite the application closing in February. Brian Fisher, director of DHSE, describes more damages were found on properties after the snow melted.
We assumed and we knew that folks may have discovered additional damages either at their subsistence camps or at their primary residences once the snow melted this winter. And we're here to make sure that people understand they can come back to FEMA, come back to the state, and identify those damages that they might not have seen in the fall and potentially receive more assistance.
More than $1.8 million was distributed after Governor Mike Dunleavy issued a disaster declaration, which activated the state's individual assistance program in 2022. While the application closed in February, programs are available for those who were unable to access their properties or receive financial assistance after the typhoon. Duke Davis, the federal coordinating officer of FEMA, says about 1,200 FEMA assistance applications were filed and $6.8 million was distributed. Davis adds that FEMA is now trying to learn what assistance rural communities still need.
We have about 8 or 10 folks on the ground that are following up now and going out into communities and having a discussion with them. Okay, we've gone through with the individual assistance program and now the public assistance program as well. Are there other unmet needs out there in the community that are not being covered by these two programs?
Typhoon Murbach caused severe damages to several communities of Western Alaska, totaling to over 1,200 miles of coastline across 35 communities. Many families lost their camps, houses, and materials. The typhoon was the region's strongest storm in more than half of a century. Fisher says the state is now dealing with massive amounts of lost coastline.
Up and down the entire coast from southwest all the way up to northwest, we've seen some pretty dramatic coastal changes. A lot more permafrost is exposed now, and that's just going to cause even more rapid degradation and melting of the permafrost because of the effects of the typhoon that hit us. So we're going to see changes from this for years and years to come.
Although applications closing in February, those who wish to appeal FEMA decisions are still able to do so within a 60-day period. If it is past that 60-day period, those who appeal must explain the reason for the delay. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is offering up to $40,000 to homeowners affected by the disaster. There is no deadline to apply. Program qualifications and terms can be found on the USDA website. Native Movement is providing a one-time grant of $500 per qualifying household impacted by Typhoon Murbach. Eligibility requirements can be found online at nativemovement.org. Coarix Land Management Services is assisting in defining and marking land boundaries. Fisher says having an emergency preparedness kit is an important step in preparing and protecting your household.
So it'd be good to have 3 days of supplies on hand for every member of your household. It'd be better to have a week of supplies, and it really would be best to have 14 days of supplies.
Fisher adds that having an emergency preparedness kit readily available prepares not only you, but your family for unexpected events to come. Reporting from Nome, I'm Ava White.
Governor Mike Dunleavy met with legislators and local officials in Nome on Friday to sign Senate Bill 98 into law. The legislation will transfer management of the $1 billion Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. KNOM's Greg Knight reports.
According to the Alaska Energy Authority, a state agency, the PCE program provides economic assistance to communities and residents that use a rural electric utility, where the cost of electricity can be 3 to 5 times higher than for customers in more urban areas of the state. House Finance Co-Chair Representative Neil Foster says the bill will protect the corpus of the endowment from legislators that might want to tap into it for other future projects.
What this bill is going to do is going to help to protect it. We'll do two things. We'll maximize the returns that it receives, and it also will help to protect it, because some years we get other legislators who want to maybe take some of these $1 billion that's currently sitting there for rural Alaska and use it for other purposes.
Representative Bryce Edgman, also a co-chair of House Finance, says the bill will allow the endowment to grow year over year, the way the permanent fund does.
I'd say this is a historic bill because it takes the permanent fund corporation and allows the power cost equalization program to be managed alongside it.
Senator Donnie Olson of Golovin is one of three co-chairs of Senate Finance. He says keeping power rates low in rural Alaska can be a matter of grave importance if people have to leave small towns or villages and move to urban areas.
When you have such expensive cost for electricity out in rural Alaska like we have down there in Golovin, it's one of those things that takes the edge off. And what we've seen in other communities is that people that cannot afford to live in rural Alaska, they are the ones that go down to Anchorage and become part of the homeless population. And so that's why I think it's such an important issue for people in rural Alaska, especially those that are having such a hard time making ends meet out there.
After signing the bill, the governor remarked about how, without people being able to afford to live in rural Alaska, there really isn't much of an Alaska.
When people say this is a subsidy, in a way it's not. It's really converting oil money into a usable method by which people, especially rural Alaska, where the costs are high because of small scale, transportation, etc., enable the people in rural Alaska to at least be able to afford to live in rural Alaska. And you don't have much of Alaska unless you have a rural Alaska.
Additionally, House Finance Co-Chair Delana Johnson and Senator Lyman Hoffman attended the bill signing event. Reporting in Nome from the Richard Foster Center, I'm Greg Knight.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage resident builds a ferry house tour in a local park.
To me, the point of the ferry trail is to really stop and look around you.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
Anchorage officials and business leaders announced today that they have closed the biggest deal to date in a green financing program's short history. Through the city's CPACER program, a national bank has loaned $5.5 million to the Alaska Hotel Group, which is renovating the former Aviator Hotel downtown. The money is paying for upgrades that will give the building a smaller carbon footprint, higher property value, and lower operating costs. From a room stripped down to concrete floors and steel beams, one of the leaders of the hotel group, Sheldon Fisher, says they're already seeing savings in their electric bill.
A third-party engineer estimated that we would save around $600,000 a year over a 20-year expected life. That will be more than $12 million. And that's not bad for a $5.5 million investment.
Over the life of the loan, the property owners must pay extra property taxes to the city, which in turn repays the loan. Melanie Lucas-Conwell directs the municipality's CPACER program, which was established in 2021 after a state law made these programs possible. So far, Lucas-Conwell says Anchorage is the only city or borough in the state with an active program.
The reason for having this event is to promote it and to show to more property owners that it is not as risky as it might seem and that pretty much every property in Anchorage should be doing a CPACER project, frankly.
Lucas-Conwell said her position and the city's CPACER program are funded through the program's own fees, not taxpayer dollars. Former U.S. Senator and Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich, another hotel group leader, says he hopes to reopen as a boutique hotel with 252 rooms in about 6 months. The renovations will include a new restaurant, microbrewery, and heated decks with views of Denali. Begich says the hotel will be rebranded, but he can't share the new name yet. It will be attached to a national franchise. A man who ran a major drug dealing operation between Seattle and Fairbanks has been sentenced to 50 years in prison. An Alaska Department of Law release says 33-year-old Cody Stockton, the self-described Pablo Escobar of Fairbanks, was a main supplier of heroin and methamphetamine to the Fairbanks area between February 2021 and April 2022. It says two large packages of meth sent from Seattle to Fairbanks were linked to Stockton, as well as women hired to carry heroin in their body cavities on flights from Seattle to Fairbanks. Also last week, Stockton was sentenced to 15 years for an unrelated January 2021 robbery, after which he fled to Seattle and began the drug trafficking operation under the alias Randall Malow. The drug and robbery sentences will be served consecutively for a combined total of 65 years in prison. Meanwhile, Ketchikan City Council will soon consider whether to renew its lease with the only 24/7 emergency shelter in town, or possibly to change the terms. The conversation comes amid recent public testimony about illegal or inappropriate activity in and around the shelter. KRBD's Reagan Miller visited the First City Haven to speak with staff and shelter users about their experiences.
Zach Merrick was at the shelter Wednesday morning, dressed in a brown t-shirt and jeans, watching a movie in the common area filled with recliners and couches. He lost his job in Petersburg. He couldn't find a new one and decided to move to Ketchikan to see if things got better for him in a bigger town, but they didn't.
You find out a lot about a place by how they treat the homeless people on the streets.
Merrick says he's used other shelters in the state, like in Anchorage, and also some down south.
I do believe this is the best one that I've ever seen, so.
He says that's because there isn't as much violence and there aren't gangs. He says Ketchikan is doing a good job.
You know, everybody should understand everybody. And if we don't understand everybody, then there's a missing piece somewhere.
But despite that sentiment, local business owners and people who live in the downtown area have come to the city council to complain about illegal or inappropriate behavior from people in or around the shelter. A special session is in the works to give the council room to talk about next steps, whether to move forward with renewing the lease, and if they do, what to change. One council member has even suggested closing the shelter immediately while an audit is performed and said she heard allegations of staff using drugs. Deborah Asper is the chief executive officer of Fair City Homeless Services, the organization that runs the shelter.
Our participants live in a completely different world than what we live in, right? So their survival skills don't include paying bills, and they don't include going grocery shopping. They include, defending themselves. And when somebody is living on the streets, they go into fight or flight. And that really limits the ability their brain has to function. So, yes, we do see people getting upset and not knowing how to handle that situation and yelling.
Asper says that drug or alcohol use isn't allowed in the shelter. Those who use those substances will be asked to leave. Anthony Nunley is the security officer at the shelter.
We run a tight shift. If you violate any of the rules, and they're basic rules, you will be asked to leave. And if I believe right, we have a sign upstairs and there's 8 rules that are on it. 8 simple rules. Anybody can do it. They choose. I'm going to say 4% choose not to. Those are the ones that I have to keep an eye on.
Nunley says there's very little activity in front of the actual building. Up and down the street, where he has no authority, is different. But shelter staff can't make anyone come inside or use their services. Edward George was homeless before First City Haven was an option.
It's sure nice to get out of the weather and, you know, and have somewhere to shower and feel like a human being, you know.
George is a disabled veteran and says the current location is a game changer for him. It's downtown and connected to the bus system. There aren't hills around that make it difficult for him to get there, especially in the winter. But that could change. Asper, the CEO, says there would be a big issue if the city council wanted to change the shelter's capacity. Right now, the fire department cleared the shelter for 54 beds, and she says they don't fill all of them at night.
I mean, so if let's say that the homeless population is 1,000 people, how do you choose 10 people out of 1,000 or 15 people out of 1,000? You know, obviously not all those people need homes. But that also then creates a more of an aggressive, response from people needing these services.
She says shrinking the services or the capacity will only cause more issues outside the shelter because people won't be able to get the help that they're fighting for inside. Asper says there are at least 818 unhoused people in Ketchikan as of last year. Their public services could change depending on what the city council decides to do. Across the past 2 meetings, there's already been suggestions for changes, like reducing capacity or hours of operation. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A group of about a dozen students from around the state visited Northwest Alaska earlier this month. They're part of the program for teenage students that immerses them in the STEM field. It's called T3, or Teaching Through Technology. The program uses problem-based learning to introduce students to real-world issues facing Alaska communities. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen met a few of the program participants while they were in Kotzebue learning about renewable energy.
When I meet the students at the T3, or Teaching Through Technology program, I realize pretty quickly that they know a lot more about tech than I do. For instance, I couldn't understand why the students were learning about Raspberry Pi.
And I thought, wow, that's a weird thing because, you know, thinking in my head, like, oh, there's technology, and then there's baking.
Layla Workman, an incoming sophomore originally from the Yukon Koyukuk community of Grayling, who's living in North Pole, filled me in.
So basically, Raspberry Pi is a little green board. Like, it basically is an input and output. It has little information on it to tell it what to do.
She was one of a dozen students in town for the T3 program, which engages students across the state in STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, through real-life activities. The now international program began at the University of Alaska Fairbanks about 6 years ago with the help of a National Science Foundation grant. George Rising is a lead instructor for the program. The former high school teacher now works full-time with the program and says by engaging students in tech, they are more likely to succeed in school.
So if we give them some cool technology skills, like Raspberry Pis and programming and drones and energy curriculum, soldering and all sorts of cool tools, then they can do really powerful things and they're more likely to lean into their education. They're more likely to finish high school. They're more likely to go on to college or any form of post-secondary education.
The program is designed for high school students, but Rising says it spans from middle schoolers introduced to the program to college students hired to mentor and support the leaders. This summer, student groups traveled to 4 locations throughout the state as part of the program.
We've got a strand of students in Juneau doing climate research on the ice field. We've got a group of students in Cordova and Valdez looking at mariculture and ocean science. And we've got a group of students in Denali looking at like seismology and geology.
This was the first year the T3 group visited Kotzebue. Here, they explored sustainable energy, looking at wind turbines and solar panels before flying to Noatak to tour the site of a future solar farm. For senior Jeremy Thatcher, touring Kotzebue Electric Association's power plant was one of his favorite activities.
We walked around and saw all the generators and all the relays they had. It was whoa, these can make power.
Thatcher said after learning about Kotzebue's renewable energy projects, he was eager to return to his hometown of Bethel to explore how renewables could be used in the community.
If we could, I'd be really happy to help study if we get more power with the solar, wind, or if we even get more energy efficient.
Although the students were in the Northwest Arctic for a week, the program is year-round. There's pods, or small groups, in each community that work after school on a variety of science and technology projects. Thatcher says as part of the program, he volunteered with KYUK public radio station in Bethel, learning sound editing and conducting interviews with elders. He says the program also helped him to get his drone piloting license. One of the students, Brian Jones, was also able to learn about drones through the program. Jones is from the YK Delta community of Quinnahock. After learning about drone technology, he was able to assist in aerial mapping of the archaeology site at Nunahalak using a special camera. Jones says they are looking for sod houses that his ancestors might have used thousands of years ago.
We go to some areas with either bright or green or dark grass. The camera sees it, but not with us, because we don't really see it with our eyes, but the camera does, because it's built for that. And we're looking for more sod houses that didn't get found.
While the after-school program is not yet in Kotzebue, Rising says that they hope to expand the program to incorporate more Northwest Arctic communities. More information about the program can be found at t3alliance.org. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
A new development in Anchorage won't solve the housing crisis anytime soon unless you're a tiny winged mythical creature who lives in the forest. An Anchorage resident is building a fairy house tour in a local park. Alaska Public Media's Ammon Swenson ventured into the woods to find out more.
If you're walking in Russian Jack Park this summer, you might come across a side trail with a birch bark sign that says, "Fairies live here." A short walk up the narrow winding path through the lush forest reveals miniature structures made from natural materials. Some look like fancy animal burrows, and others look like mouse-sized houses adorned with moss and bark. But these homes are intended for fairy folk.
It's magic!
Barbara Brown was at the park on a recent Friday, setting up the trail and helping people build their own houses from materials she brought. She organized building the fairy trail after traveling and seeing similar projects in places like Oregon and Toronto.
And then I said, okay, that's it. This is too much fairy stuff. We gotta have one in Anchorage.
Brown pitched the idea to Parks and Rec, and they recommended Russian Jack Park. After doing some research, she learned fairy houses can be found around the world.
And there are so many books about how to design them. Building one out of pumpkins, building one out of logs. It's huge.
She says her daughter loved fairies as a child, but Brown didn't feel the same way as a kid.
I was into witches, so this was all very new to me, but fairies overtook our house.
Brown teamed up with the Anchorage Museum Seed Lab to host a fairy house building workshop. Some of those houses can be seen on the trail. An architectural firm contributed a detailed house straight out of the Swiss Family Robinson, complete with a spiraling staircase. As we spoke, a couple arrived with two young kids carrying their own creations.
So one is lots of trees, lots of moss. Oh, now this one, they even used sea glass? Oh, look at this. It's like a whole little shelter. These are just terrific.
Daniel, who did you say was going to live in yours? Which fairy?
I can't remember.
The tooth fairy?
Oh, great.
Sherry Douglas is friends with Brown and has been involved with the project since the beginning. As a retired youth services librarian, she says she has lots of favorite fairy stories. Her fairy house was more of a fairy spa, complete with a scallop shell bathtub.
And to me, the point of the fairy trail is to really stop and look around you and just look and be in nature and let your mind be blank and see what pops up into your imagination and what you're actually seeing in the woods there.
Brown says the trail will stay up indefinitely with Parks and Rec's approval, but she will be regularly monitoring the area, keeping things tidy. To find it, walk left past the Russian Jack Chalet, cross the bridge at the bottom of the hill, and look for the sign. In Anchorage, I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra, Jeremy Shea and Ammon Swenson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ava White and Greg Knight in Nome, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Would you like to play a part in a public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.